following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, A.K.A. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, I don't know who's out there, maybe 8 or 10 or 44 people.
Or 44,000.
Or 44,000, we don't know. But this is All of the Above with Norman Lear and his sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Hello, Norman.
Double P. If anybody should be writing him, it's H-I-P-P.
That's right.
Every once in a while, he'll get a letter with H-I-P, and it hurts. It really hurts him. So H-I-P-P, please.
Yes. Do you know I was once asked if Hip was my last? No, it occurred to me. People would ask me, is Hip your real last name, which it is. And then it occurred to me in my 40s, one day, like a bolt of lightning, that if I knew somebody who was like an actor and a guitar player, and I thought he changed his name to Hip, to be hip, I would think he was kind of an idiot. And then all of a sudden, I was terrified that for 40-some years, I've been meeting people, and they've been going, oh, douchebag.
And you thought that important enough to tell me.
I thought, I'm obsessed with that. Yeah. I not only tell you, but tell the 44,000 people that are listening.
And while you're doing that, we have guests who are on their way in here, and yeah. I want them to hear.
I want Judd.
From the beginning.
Yes. I'll tell it again.
Ladies and gentlemen, the door out there is open. See, there's a glass that separates us from the outside. And walking through that door, that's the door opening now.
Wow, this is great.
The door is being performed by the actor, Judd Hirsch. And he is our guest with Jermaine. Your name is?
Fowler.
Fowler.
Yes,
why
sir.
Was I going to say Greer?
I don't know. Because David Allen? Greer?
David Allen,
maybe
Jermaine
I look
Greer?
Like David? Yeah. Pam Greer, maybe?
Maybe it's the GG.
It might be the GG.
It might be the alliteration.
I do get Pam Greer
the
a lot,
Pam
though.
You got a Pam Greer vibe.
I got her cheekbones. Yeah,
you do.
Indeed. I do. That's a compliment. Thank you
but,
very much.
But we don't have an entrance line for you, Judd. Would you make one up?
Yeah, my last name is Hirsch.
Yes.
One asked me why would I keep it? You know what I mean? Why would I keep it all the way through? Just like Paul's hips. You know? Yeah. So I thought, that would probably describe me, so no one would have a question. It describes me. But then I remembered it's German, and how would anyone know? So they said, I went and found out what it meant, and it means male deer.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Male deer, that's very interesting.
Yeah. I didn't know that until I saw something on television when it had a little sign outside a bar, and it said, Rote Deer Inn, which means Red Deer Inn. And I went, Rote Hirsch. And I said, wait a minute. That's probably misspelled because it's my name. I mean, I never thought my name would be anything like a word.
Right. But it fits the accent.
When I found it out.
I like that it
I
fits
said,
the
it's,
accent.
It's male. Yeah. Luckily, it wasn't the female deer.
But it's a German name.
Yes, definitely.
So it's hip.
And it's really the way it's spelled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's a good. Would you have a story about your name?
Yes, I have a story about my name. I was born in 68 Woodstock Street, Hartford, Connecticut. No, I wasn't. I was born at New Haven Hospital. Can you imagine a man being old enough to forget where he was born?
I can't imagine.
Like Satchel Paige.
Where was he born?
They don't know.
They don't know ever?
No. They don't know when or where.
And he didn't either.
He didn't know either.
I was born in New Haven Hospital, 95 years, some months, some weeks, some days ago. I mean, God, I'm old. And I'm sitting across the room, this young guy with his hair, mine, and Judd's.
Hey, look, we still have hair.
You actually do. Judd has a full head of hair, and it's very inspirational, actually.
And when I met Jermaine, it was on the first reading of our show. I mean, because I didn't know anybody. They just brought me in, and I sat down next to him, and he just
that show is Superior
Donuts.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the Superior Donuts, and we were just about to have a reading. I said, what? How old could you be? And he said, 28. And I said, that's the exact opposite of my age.
Yeah, wow, yeah.
And he didn't believe me.
I thought you were in your 60s. You have the energy of mine. Like, Judd really, he doesn't miss a step, man. Like, the man wakes up ready for work. He's happy to be there. And his energy is...
But the first meeting, I thought you thought I was a liar.
I did.
Yeah.
Right. What made you think he was a liar? Is that okay?
He didn't think that I was, you know...
Because he's 80.
What's happening?
I'm going to push that mic closer to Judd.
Hey, Judd, a little closer to the mic.
Yeah. Oh, Joe, I thought you were
talking. Nobody heard a word.
Keep going.
All right, you want to start from the beginning?
Use your theater voice.
Yeah, we don't have to
start. Project,
who knows what evil lurks there in the hearts of men.
Now, that's a two-time Tony winner right there.
Who did that? Was that the Shadow? The Shadow Knows.
Yeah.
Who did?
That's Lamont Cranston.
Oh,
that was the guy's name. Yeah,
I thought that was the guy who did War of the Worlds from back in the day.
Could have been the same guy. You know what I mean?
Got his name, the radio guy.
No,
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles. Oh yeah, they're doing it. Never mind. They're doing a play about it now.
About the
somebody's doing it.
Orson Welles.
A play of Orson Welles or a play of yours?
No. Hey, listen. You had trouble remembering where you were born. I had trouble memorizing what I've done.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Well,
he still remembers his babysitter when he was two years old.
Yeah,
he told me about his babysitter vividly.
She just died yesterday.
Oh my God!
Is that right? Really? What's her name? Let's pay tribute.
Oh man, that's terrible. You know, because I got one. Why don't you call Dorothy? Because I knew I was two. Dorothy, I don't know how old she was. She was a teenager, and then I went to visit her. And then I said, oh, Dorothy, do you remember all the addresses we lived at? And she said, sure, of course I remember. And I said, oh, could you just tell me because I really want to catch up. And we moved so many times. And she said, I said, do you remember when I was at a crib? I just remember this. I was in a crib. I was crying because my mother and father went out that night. She said, yeah, they did that, yeah. We had a bathroom down the hall. And that's why I remember it. It's like a dream. Mm. And then she said, yeah, I do remember that. And I'm looking at this woman thinking, I'm old. This one's got to be ancient. I remember this. So I got her sort of 99th birthday sort of like in the mail. And then I just got one yesterday saying, well, she passed.
Oh. She passed at 99?
Yeah, 99.
It's good you spoke with her before.
That's a good run.
It's a great run, right?
You never harassed her or anything, did you?
You never know. You know, in the...
Or did she ever harass you?
It was a different time.
At this day and time, I got to look back and find out. What did I do?
Well, then, could you get out of your crib yourself?
No. I was really...
So you had, she had to get in the crib for you to harass her.
I was a big boy. I was 9 pounds born.
Right. Wow. I didn't live a day of my life with my folks where they could afford somebody to take care of me.
Mm. No, I'm telling you.
We were
poorer than you.
I want to bet.
Well, we lived on the Lower East Side in New York.
Yes.
Where did you live?
I lived at 68 Woodstock Street, Hartford, Connecticut, I was born.
You know, anybody...
but it was the mean streets of Hartford, Norman, Connecticut.
Norman, anybody hearing anything Connecticut means you're rich.
Is that right?
Well...
There are a lot of hoods in Connecticut.
Huh?
I learned a lot of hoods in Connecticut, a lot of bad neighborhoods in Connecticut.
Oh, of course there are.
Yeah, but like when I think Connecticut, I think, you know, you think rich people for some reason. And I learned that it's not the truth.
Where do you think he's from? Where do you think Jermaine is from? Just take a look at him.
I don't know. First of all, I have to find out, was he born?
I was born in 88.
You didn't just turn up.
No. I was born in 88, you know. I didn't sprout up like a flower. But I was born in 88, and... 29, and you can guess the place I was born.
You'll never.
You can never guess the place.
No,
I gave you three places, three tries.
Yeah. Each of us, Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay, close.
That's not bad.
Yeah, a little bit.
I guess in the,
tiny.
It's in the
Northeast.
Yeah,
more or less.
Born in the Northeast.
Ish. Yeah. It's debatable, but
Northeast, Southish.
So it's Canada.
Below Canada. Below Canada. Way below Canada.
Way below Canada is Florida.
Between Florida and Canada, how about that?
Between Florida, we are narrowing in on this.
We're doing
this
a good job.
I was just trying to keep you from guessing some southern states. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm from Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Ooh, no,
it's close, but you know, I'm from D.C. I was born in D.C. Raised
born
in
D.C.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
DC.
That?
I'm sorry.
Can you imagine him coming? Born in D.C., but you lived in Maryland.
Maryland for most of my life. Hyattsville, Maryland, PG County.
I can imagine that.
Yeah.
D.C. I can't never remember meeting anybody from Washington, D.C. That's like not having a birth a place. You know what I mean?
Because it's like so political and the White House is there. You just can't picture living there. Yeah, I used to think that. I didn't think civilians lived in D.C. I just thought the president and like – you know, the Secret Service lived in D.C. when I was a kid. And then I got older. I'm like, oh, you can live here? Had no idea.
But the majority of the people who live in D.C. are black.
They used to be. It's changing now. It's getting really gentrified, actually.
Oh, yeah.
The stadium's, like, moving a lot of people out.
People like me?
No, you're cool. Oh, okay. No, you're good. Because you're old school. You're fine. Actually, you would have lived there and people would have loved you, actually. Black women love you.
Look. Okay, let's talk
I imagine they're feeling a little less welcomed. These days.
I don't want to talk about age, but look, I'm doing the show on the protest, the Superior Donuts, because they have put me in a place where all the jokes are about my age.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
They have put me in a place that I can't get out of. They have put me so far back that I actually recognize myself. The actor recognizes you, the character.
The references are about Judd now.
Yeah. So wait, they looked up my background.
I saw the play. I may be the only person in this room.
Yes,
I saw
are.
The play in Chicago with Tracy Letts.
Tracy was inspired by you to do that play, actually.
Yeah, he was inspired by what?
By you to do the play.
Yeah.
I think he told me that then. I was with my daughter. My
true story.
She was 12 years old. She just loved that show.
Mm-hmm.
I was taking her to a summer camp. I can't remember the name of the camp nearby Chicago. And we had an evening in Chicago. We went to see Superior Donuts. And here we are all this time later.
I didn't know it was a play.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Broadway. Tell us about the play.
It went to Broadway, too.
Yeah. Wow.
If you saw it. I'm terribly interested in what it was like. You haven't seen our show.
I have not seen it.
It can't be just like it, but the characters are. In other words, it was based on the fact that a guy like Jermaine and a guy like me were the two leads of it, right?
Yeah, yes.
And this was a guy from the 60s or something like that? Me?
Arthur, yeah.
And what's the African-American kid? Where is he now that played the part?
He one of them hit me up on Twitter, actually, and told me how much he loved the show. I forgot his name. I'm not sure, actually.
Uh-huh.
I'm not really sure. But we do get a lot of, like, you know, some of them who have played the original characters do mess. I don't think you get a lot of people who hit you up. You don't have social media.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm off.
I'm going to get you an Instagram. I'm going to get you an Instagram.
Social media. If I see anything about me on social media, the only thing you hear is, ah! Get that off.
You have a fan page on Twitter, by the way. I don't know if you know that.
I wouldn't know.
You do? Well, you have a fan page.
No social media for you?
No.
How many years ago was I'm Not Rappaport?
1986.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is a play by Herb Gardner. And two people sitting on a park bench. Was there a third? Did anybody else ever walk in?
No, it was just me and Cleavon Little in the play. And other people arrive. I mean, it's in Central Park. Two guys in Central Park. Actually, Herb told me how he wrote the play. This is the fastest play he ever wrote.
Yes.
Believe it or not, he used to take 3-4 years to write a play. He was sitting in an office where he writes his stuff. I think, in fact,
it's probably the apartment that Barbara is still living in, I believe.
No, not there. No, he was on right where Columbus Circle is. He was looking across the street at two guys sitting on a bench. Now, he was so far away he couldn't really see what they were doing or saying, but he watched these two guys who he knew didn't know each other, who eventually got into some kind of a row with each other, just talking to each other. So he just looked at them and said, I wonder if I can make this guy a commie. And he just wrote the play as quickly as he could. You know?
Wow.
Effort.
Yeah. So it made me think, if you had a little helicopter, you know, you'd come in on them and with a little microphone and hit them. And you see, first of all, they're just sitting there. They're just sitting there doing absolutely nothing. At the beginning of the play, they're doing absolutely nothing. And they're staring. He's reading a paper, and I'm just staring in the distance. The first line is, okay, so where was I?
That's a good way.
Was that the first line of the play?
First line of the play.
That's awesome.
Okay, so where was I? What was I talking about? I was about to make an important point. He says, I wasn't listening. That was the beginning of the play.
Herbie Gardner was one of the most delicious people I've ever known. And that's the word, delicious.
Mm-hmm. He was very.
Oh, my God, right. I loved him.
I'm so sorry he didn't, you know, live longer. I mean, you know.
He added time to my life. I guess I didn't add enough time to his. No, I mean it. I think laughter does that. I am convinced.
You're right, Norman.
You've made a few people laugh.
No, but you're right. That is the absolute truth. I believe comedy gives you length of time.
I believe it.
And if you live it, and you're, you know what I mean? It's it's really part of your life, you know? How much have we done in situation comedy or all comedy on television? I mean, you can count the years, right?
How about sitting around a table with a group of guys and we're trying to think of stuff that's going to make 200 people in a live audience laugh and then millions of people following laugh. Mm. And my God, how we laughed. Then I would stand off in back of 240-odd people. As they watch the teleplay, as they watch the actors presenting it in front of them. And on a belly laugh, the way an audience comes out of its seat and goes forward a little and then comes back.
That's a real laugh.
That wave is as spiritual. It's, you know, obviously it's funny, but it's so deeply spiritual because you, at that moment, people are connected like, I don't know what else in the world can connect them the way they're connected when they're experiencing a belly laugh.
Yeah. Hmm.
And they're really close up, you know. They're really close up. I mean, we can almost, if we wanted to, we could talk to them.
Touch them and talk
right?
to them.
Right? Which Jermaine does a lot.
Yeah. I love talking to the audience before.
He does. He does.
I want to know who I'm making laugh most of the time. I do stand up, so like, you know, I talk to the audience all the time. So it's just a natural thing for me to do. So before the shows, like go in the audience and introduce Judd and Katie Seagal and the cast, you know, and just bring them on stage. And after the show, I tell them, thank you, you know. I want to do stand-up, actually, one of those nights in front of the audience.
Oh, that's what you should do.
I would love to. Just in between takes and whatnot, if we're not getting notes in between the takes, I would love to try and do that.
Yeah, I mean, why not? Yeah.
I don't see why not.
It just pours just out of you, wasn't
it? Yeah. Did anybody do that for, like,
warm up an audience?
Yeah.
Well, the way... It's very different the way we're doing one day at a time now with an audience. And the audience comes at 5 o'clock, 5:30 we start, and the same people are sitting there at 9:30, 10 o'clock. Years ago, we did a show at 5 and another show for a second audience at 8.
That's right. Okay. That was tape. That was tape.
Yeah. We only do
was
tape.
That All in the Family?
Was it we made it 5 and 8.
Yeah, and this is the same. I'm sorry. What was it? No.
One day at a time.
One day at a time was two. You said two shows too.
No, we're doing it. We're doing it now, and we do it one time.
One time.
But the audience sits there for hours, and an MC, a comic, or whatever keeps them stirred up. For the 4 hours they're sitting there. Same it's just amazing.
Yeah, we got a great one. I mean, he does everything.
What's his name?
Ron Pearson.
And he does juggling.
Juggles. Yeah.
And he gets on a unicycle.
A unicycle. But it's not even just that. His crowd work is beautiful.
Yeah.
He really riles them up. You know what I mean?
For 3 hours, for 4 hours. They never stop.
It's an art form that
is. It is a rare art form.
It's underappreciated. Yeah. I really thank that guy.
We keep saying.
I can't remember. I'm ashamed. I can't remember the name of the guy that does it for us.
Okay.
And I view him the same way. He's a marvel.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a unicycle.
I think the unicycle was added later in his career when he realized he had to be there longer than he thought he had to be. He's like, I gotta get a unicycle, man. I gotta get me a
juggle. But he balances a ladder on his chin and juggles.
Yeah. Sometimes he's funnier than us. And I get jealous. Yeah. Yeah, I get jealous. Funny. Oh, I hate him. I'm like, yo, man, come on. You ain't the show. I get mad sometimes.
Talk about us. Every once in a while he said, oh, yeah, by the way, there's Jermaine Fowler. I like the by the ways in the warm-ups.
Yeah. You know? After the show, he gets autographs. I'm like, he's getting autographs everywhere? Right. Oh, man. He ain't Judd Hirsch is here.
Judd, when did you know you wanted to be in the business, an actor?
Well, I had to go through an awful lot of crazy stuff, and even before I even could even imagine it, I was one of these kids, as I said, poor kid, and I knew that I was going to have to make a living, so I had to get educated in something, right? So I decided I was going to be an engineer. So I went to college to become an engineer. And then while I'm in college and engineer,
What made you decide you wanted to be an engineer?
I was good in math and science. That was the answer. I was good in math and science when you were in high school.
Uh-huh. You still are.
And you get scared. You say, oh, great, what am I going to do when I go to – well, you're good in math and science, so do that. Okay. Well, like what? Well, you could do this, or this. You could be an engineer. I said, it's the guy who runs a train. No, not that kind of engineer. Okay. Then I found out what an engineer was like. I went to college. And then halfway through, I should say three-quarters of the way through, I was with my friend, and we were both in engineering school. We were both walking down the corridors of City College in New York, and I said, you don't want to do this, do you? And he said, no, do you? I said, no. Drop the books. Walk away. That's what we did.
Wow.
Dropped the books, walked away. I was still in school, so I changed my subject. I went to art. I went to anything. And they had a one-credit course for acting. Never before. I mean, and it was really like a speech class, right? And this guy who I had, he had wore a bow tie, and it was all speech. You know, he said, we speak perfectly in this class here. And he said, I'm going to read a poem to you. And he read the poem. It was Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. And it starts with, you know, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. And I said, oh, it's a beautiful sound. He said, what does fill up with snow sound like? It sounds like the snow falling when you're alone. This is what the sound of snow is, fill up with snow. Mm. And I said, my God, we can act that. And from there on, I decided. If I can affect anybody with something like, you know, a story which is written like that, I'm sorry, but I didn't, you know, do Shakespeare.
That's amazing.
It inspired me.
That was a moment that actually occurred in your life.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
And you said what? You said, I want to write like that?
I want to say those things. I want to read poems. I want to say these things on a stage. And infect people with the language.
And you were 17?
No, I was in college.
Oh, you were in college.
Yeah, I was in my
20s. So you were 17 and a half.
You think I'm that smart? No, yeah. I'm not. Then I went to another school. And then I went to become an architect and art school. I told Jermaine, I went to art school. He's playing a guy in our show who is now in this show that we're doing right now, goes to art school.
Yeah, Franco goes to art school.
And he's really a street painter.
Mm-hmm. When did you know you wanted to become an actor?
Me, right? Man, an actor. I knew I wanted to make people laugh when I was in about fourth or fifth grade after watching The Simpsons. I used to do the impressions of, like, you know, Ralph Wiggum and all the characters in The Simpsons in school. I knew I wanted to be like a professional actor after watching. I was at home in Maryland, watching this movie called The Rock with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. And I loved it. I watched it every day. In fact, I wrote a sequel to that movie when I was 11. Because I wanted to be in it. I was like, one day I'm going to be in that movie. And it just made me want to write. That made me want to write, you know, movies. And I got older and I realized I wanted to do stand-up comedy when I was in 12th grade. I was 17, turning 18. And my neighbor let me borrow Eddie Murphy Raw on VHS tape. And he's wearing a purple leather outfit. And I was like, this is weird. And popped into my VHS tape player. And I watched that special twice in a day. And that's when I realized, oh, okay, I can't act here in Maryland because there's no Broadway here. There's no theaters here at all, at the time at least. And I know how to get started. But I was like, you know what I can do? I can do what Eddie did. I'll use stand-up as a way to act. So I started my stand-up career, and I used that as a, you know, catapult, you know, as a launching pad to start my acting career. But I, you know, I fell in love with stand-up immediately because it's the one thing I can control. And really, like, you know, there's no network notes. There's no, like, you know, there's no. it's mine. No one can tell me.
No network notes.
Not at all.
God, I get network notes as a parent.
Well, you got to do stand-up, Norman. You got to get on stage, baby. Yeah, I was when I. Those are the three, like. Those are the three, like, you know, I guess corners, like, you know, when I first realized I wanted to make people laugh and be an actor and then do stand up. But I went backwards and do stand up to start my acting career, you know. And now, you know, I do this show. It's cool because, like, you know, doing a multicam show helps me do my stand up. And doing stand up helps me do my multicam because I'm in front of a live audience all the time. But, like, you know, I'm not afraid of a live audience and reading, you know, the scripts and whatnot, because it just gives me, I have this confidence that I've built for 10 years doing stand up. And doing stand up, I'm really comfortable doing different characters, you know, during the act out. So it's that.
What percentage of the people you guys run into would, if you can, it's probably a guess, watch the show?
What percentage of people? You mean
the people you run into? What percentage of the population do they represent who are watching Superior Donuts?
I know we get 3 million views. We got 3.1 the last time we
household.
Aired.
That was a household.
Yeah.
So you got to multiply that.
Yeah, but I get recognized more in Toronto. Like, I got recognized in Canada a lot from the show. It was strange. You know, you go to L.A., you're driving a lot, and you don't really get that, you know, you don't get people, you know, donuts, because it's such a lonely city, L.A., you know what I mean? Because you're alone a lot here. You're driving alone. You're going to auditions alone.
You're not walking through crowds.
No, it's not like New York. Mm. In New York, I get recognized a lot because you're around the people. You're around people all the time, you know.
But, I was wondering when you would make it. Now I know.
Thank you, man.
It's
I appreciate
now.
That a lot.
Now.
Yeah, but right.
Paul's in a show. He's been in a show for some years.
Yeah, the middle.
Do you get recognized a lot?
I get recognized in the middle of the country, which is appropriate because the show is called The Middle on ABC.
I recognize you, but I didn't know the name of the show.
The Middle, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But I had an experience. I was just in Memphis, and we went to Elvis Presley's birthplace, which is a two-room shotgun shack. And in the first room, the room where Elvis was born, there's a nice lady. She's in her 90s. She knew Elvis. She knew Vernon. She knew Gladys's mom. Ooh. And there is a rope, a red rope across. Now, the room is only, you're here, and you take one step, and you'd be on the other side of the rope. But anyway, she said, "You've been here before, haven't you?" And I said, "No, I've never been here, ma'am." She said, "I know I've seen you before." And I said, "I've never been here." She said, and my wife said, "Do you watch The Middle?" And she said, "Reverend Tim Tom." And she lifted the rope across. She lifted the rope, and I was able to step onto the other side of the room and the shotgun shack and Elvis's birthplace. I thought, that's enough for me.
That is
beautiful,
I'll
take it.
Man. I'll tell you, the Midwest.
That's my level of fame, and I'll take that.
Dude, the Midwest is a beautiful place when you, like, when you, they welcome you. They watch TV, you know, like,
well, that's down
else.
South. Same there, Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah. They're just, man, so open.
That place, the South, the Midwest, like, they watch TV.
Yeah.
And they welcome you. Like, we did a stand-up tour. Judd was in the New York stop, and but when we hit Chicago and we hit Philadelphia, excuse me, and DC, it felt like it was the first time I've been out to different cities that have watched our show since we premiered, because I've been in LA for, you know,
you're
just
gay?
Filming and whatnot. Huh?
You're gay?
No, I'm not gay.
Just said first time you've been out.
No, not gay out.
This is an exclusive.
Out of LA. Yeah,
an exclusive.
Jermaine's
like,
coming
of
out
the
of the closet on podcast one. Norman, I trust you with this information. Okay? Like, I feel so comfortable with you that I think it's time to tell you I'm gay as hell, man. I'm gay for Norman Lear.
We're not going to know, Jermaine. We're not going to know when Norman gets it wrong. We're just not going to know. It's going to be in the paper.
Yeah, that's the name of our other podcast, Gay for Norman Lear.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I'm glad we cleared that up, Norman. I'm glad you did.
You ought to have a column.
What do your girlfriend?
Norman Lear says. And all of the wrong information, I think.
In high school, I had a column, Notes to You, from King Lear.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I can't wait to get the Variety article that comes out, the headline, Norman Lear breaks out breaks out Jermaine Fowler. I'm not gay, but I'll take it. I don't care.
No, I just wanted you to, I mean, people can't see us right now, but I just wanted you to know the Norman. See, while he's telling that story about how he became an actor and why he was doing stand-up, that's the actor. That's the guy who wants to be the actor more than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we get in our show. When they write the stories for him, you know, and I always say, just make them as deep as you can, right? We had a few.
Yeah, we in the writer's room, usually what happens is Judd is the best. I'll tell Judd stories about me growing up back home, and he'll be like, use it. Go upstairs and tell him. I go in the writer's room because, you know, I'm also EP on the show. I get to go in the writer's room and really ground the character. Tell him, hey, man, I don't think Franco would say this because I'll tell you my experience in this particular situation. I did that. I used to do that. My mom was this way. My dad was like that. You know, I tell them these stories, and I usually do them on stage, actually, and they work. And, you know, it's actually like it grounds the character a little bit.
Well, you know, in the history of situation comedy, I'm pretty sure that all writers and all the producers always try to pick out the things about the actors they have as far as their history is concerned and use it, right?
Yeah.
They did it with me.
Well, you got to be careful what stories you tell
on taxi,
at lunch,
oh,
right? Because
yeah.
it ends up in the script.
When I got in the taxi, the first thing I read the first day, because we had the reading the first day, and it said Alex Taylor. And I read the whole thing, and then I finally said, okay, let's. That sounds pretty good. And I said, wait a minute. I can't play Taylor. And they said, What do you mean? I said, I can't play a guy by the name of Taylor. Why? I said, because it's going to be like plain. It's like calling me Smith. You know, I cannot play a tailor. They said, well, then who else? Right. So I started to think. And I felt the funniest guy I ever met in junior high school was a guy by the name of Rieger.
Rieger.
Yeah. And I remember how he spelled his name. And I remember how everyone said Rieger. And so I loved the name. I loved it. You know, not only was it German, okay, but he was like Rieger.
Yeah.
He was a funny guy. So I immediately said, can you call him Rieger? I said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. That was it. That's how Rieger was born. We never heard me say it. Never played Taylor.
What's funny, as soon as you started talking about the name of your character, I heard Danny DeVito in my head.
Rieger. Yeah, Rieger.
That's how Burroughs pronounces it. Like, remember that day we had that callback to Alex Rieger and that episode? He wanted to use that. It couldn't make the air.
No, you couldn't do that.
Jimmy Burroughs is like, hey, Fowler. I'm like, yeah, what's up, Jimmy? Call him Rieger.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm like, I guess. And it murdered. I was like, yeah, Jimmy, you funny as hell.
Is Jimmy directing the show?
Not this season. He's doing a lot of Will and Grace. Uh-huh. Actually, he's back. You know, that's his baby. That's his show. So he's doing that. But he stops by the set sometimes, give his blessing.
He's done the pilot of everything you've ever heard. He probably did a pilot of your show anytime?
The craziest thing is that we never worked together.
Oh, yeah.
And have you two worked together?
No.
Almost. Well, oh, yes, once.
In
once.
A sense.
Yes,
in
once.
A sense. I mentioned I'm Not Rappaport.
Yeah, we did a thing called I Love Liberty. He produced this thing called
I Love Liberty. Oh, my God. I Love Liberty, of course.
Herbie wrote it.
Of course. Herbie wrote the scene.
Herbie wrote the scene.
Now I'm going to tell you this story about that because you reminded me about this. My God, across 50 years.
Yeah, maybe.
I Love Liberty was – I wanted to do I Love Liberty. People of the American Way was 1 year old. I had started this thing called People of the American Way. And it was to take the flag and the Bible back for all of us. The flag and the Bible to this day. If you were to ask who does it belong to, left or right, it belongs to the right. Mm-hmm. Because the left doesn't claim it enough.
Yeah.
And as somebody who happens to love this country – fought in a war for it.
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't have the words to say. And who experienced, I say this a lot, and I want to say it a lot, because civics classes should be back in schools. But when I was a kid, everybody in public schools took civics.
Okay,
and we learned about the promises this country has made to everybody who is a citizen. Equal justice, equal opportunity under the law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've gone far enough into this sentence to have forgotten where I was going in the story.
I love Liberty.
I'm into it. I'm listening.
I love Liberty. So we did the only way I could get it on the air was to prove its impartiality by getting, in this case, Lady Bird Johnson and President Gerald Ford to co-chair. They co-chaired the event.
Oh.
I had Barry Goldwater and Jane Fonda on the same stage.
So
it was, and Judd Hirsch.
And Valerie Harper.
And Valerie Harper and Superman and Barbara Streisand. What's his name who played Superman? Chris Reeve.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
The list is unbelievably long.
Yes.
Unbelievably long.
And we made it in front of 20,000 people at the Los Angeles Sports Arena.
They were in there.
Live.
We played it in front of live people. We televised it.
20,000 people.
I have a peek. I think I have
a peek. Yes, I have it. I haven't seen it in some time. But
so I can watch
it somewhere?
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah?
I found it on YouTube.
Is Norma getting a piece of that YouTube?
I hope so.
Get your money, Norman.
it's up there.
And Robin Williams' thing on it. Just
Robin Williams played the flag.
Oh. Wow.
He is the flag.
And
it's
so great.
If there's anybody I miss as a comic or anything in this world, a guy just to watch and talk to, it's Robin Williams.
You know what else I missed? And I saw his daughter do a one-woman show, Rain Pryor.
Rain is sweet. Rain is funny too.
She does a woman's show based on her dad.
That's awesome.
That is just wonderful. I saw it just.
Did you have her on?
Handful of nights ago, huh?
Did you have her on here?
That's a good idea.
Yeah,
get Rain on.
Where is the show? Where is it?
It was they just did it for an audience.
For a night.
Just one night in a theater I didn't even know existed.
In New York or L.A.?
Here.
In here?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Dang.
I had this idea for a film one day called Religion. Oh, it's the longest. I'm a minister of the write-in minister, $20 it cost me, I'll remember the name of the ministry in just a moment, 20 minutes, mail-order minister. But a mail-order minister is a minister in this country like anybody else who is a minister. I went to see the guy who started it, and he told me about the reason he started it. There's so much story to tell here. I'm worried about taking too fucking much time.
I'm listening, man.
Forget it, man.
That's why I'm here.
This is your show.
I'm listening to you, baby.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
I came out of the closet for you. Come on, man. I'm gay, Norman. I didn't come out the closet for nothing.
All right,
tell the damn story.
Oh, boy, do I have a new view of a character. I got to go back to do this. It ain't just about donuts, folks.
The name of the church is the Universal Life Church. It's silly. Exists.
Oh,
and
the
guy who started it because he was fed up that wealthy people could afford the attorneys and the accountants that could take all kinds of tax, you know, to save money for the client. Poor people couldn't afford that. But what they could do is become a member of the Universal Life Church and write off their garages as sanctuaries, write off their vacations as religious retreats, etc.
Right.
Through this guy, I met two policemen, but they were mounted policemen in Times Square. If you've ever seen that handful of mounted policemen in Times Square, they were two of them. They lived on Staten Island, and they were members of the Universal Life Church, and I went out and visited them. By the time I met them, they had taken a little building that had been a mortuary. It was closed. They had opened it, made it a church. And five nights a week, people who were ministers of that church came and preached for 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I saw a dentist talk about dental health as important for your spiritual life. And just so that they could photograph it and have the proof that these guys were ministering. So I wanted to, this was the idea for the screenplay. Two mounted policemen in Times Square become, one finds power, a camera finds him and he becomes a Jerry Falwell kind of type. The other guy finds God. And the guy that finds power is in desperate trouble. And at the end of it, you know, his friend who found God saves his ass. I spent an afternoon with Robin Williams and Richard Pryor talking about those roles. One of the great days of my life.
Damn, man.
That's awesome.
This was, there wasn't a word on paper. And I have 19 versions of it because, I started so many years ago that, there a lot of names you'd know were involved in writing it. We never got it right.
Wow.
And were those guys pitching ideas? Like, were you guys kicking it back and forth?
We were kicking it back and forth, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's probably where we came up with, One Finds Power and One Finds... No, I had that coming in. But...
And they would have played the Mounties.
They wouldn't be the guys.
Yeah. If you Jermaine, you've been to Times Square, haven't you? Did you ever see these guys outside the theaters? And everybody who goes to the theater, they all come over to pet the horse.
Yeah,
talk to them. They're very big horses.
Oh, they're gigantic. they're gigantic horses. That's hilarious, man.
Yeah, in the East 40s, they're 48th Street or something like that. They're the still where they keep the horses, the stables.
Yeah. I was also in a crossover in Central Park.
That sounds like I want to see that.
Yeah, but those guys.
Yeah, I just want to see
that. There's a woman out there that knows where the horses are.
Central Park. The garages in Central Park.
No, but the garages are off of Central Park.
Yeah.
And they feed them like New York pizza, the horses and stuff. I'm joking. They don't. You seem so concerned, John. You look so upset. They don't feed them pizza.
Oh, I just take everything. I take everything so seriously.
They feed them garlic knots. They don't feed them.
Jed, was it in the 60s you were getting into acting?
Yeah.
Early 60s?
I was an old actor in Stalin.
New York City?
I was about 30.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. This is in New York City.
Yes. I think my first part was Herb Gardner's Thousand Clowns. I did it in stock.
Oh, you were a Thousand Clowns too?
Yeah. It was played in 63, and I think I did it in 64 up in Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
So it had already been on Broadway, and I played it as the opening thing at the Woodstock Playhouse, the famous old Woodstock Playhouse.
Yeah.
So you did three of his plays.
I did four of his plays. He wrote five.
and you did four of the five.
I did one, two. I did one as a movie. And, oh, this is cute. I was doing this off Broadway play. we decided that we were going to have a couple more things to do if the audience came back, right? Uh-huh. This was called Tally's Folly. It was a one act play.
Oh, I remember that title.
A one act play. So I was a guy, sort of Jewish guy, and I had a beard, So Herb wrote two things. One was about an old Jewish guy in a bed having had a heart attack. He wakes up in St. Vincent's Hospital, which is very Catholic at the time. It's a cross on the wall opposite his bed. And he wakes up and sees the cross on his wall, and he goes, oh, boy. That's the first line of that play. And the next play is about a 9-year-old kid, and it's called How I Crossed the Street All by Myself. And he's in school, and he's reading his little essay on how he crossed the street. And I'm playing him in front of this audience with a beard. This is how much Herb said, I think you can get away with that. The cutest stuff this man.
Oh, wrote. That's fantastic.
And then you got Taxi from Broadway? Just right off Broadway, right to TV?
No, from a play.
From a play?
Yeah.
We did a lot of TV before.
Neil Simon play.
But you did some TV before.
What was the play?
Chapter 2.
Chapter 2.
This was like 1977, and it was here in Los Angeles. Then we went to Broadway. But your funny part about it was that one of the guys who writes Taxi, Jim, not Burroughs, he was in the audience. The play was about a guy and his brother in one part and the girlfriend who he's about to meet in the other apartment, sort of a rotating stage, And you know when you're on a rotating stage, it's one night it's not going to work. One night it didn't work and I was in the wrong apartment. Totally wrong apartment. And I sat there and thought, when my brother comes up to see me, he's going to start – I'm just going to look at his eyes, right? He says, George! He's looking at me thinking, where are you? Where are we? The stage didn't – it rotated halfway. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm doing this play. Now, the first part of it is – you come out, you have the scene, and your brother, blah, 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 and then the girls have their scene. It's kind of bifurcated, but then finally we meet on the telephone. But the first few scenes, now there's a guy who will keep hearing every time I'm talking, I hear this guy going, up, and I thought, why would he do that? There's somebody in the audience who hates this play, or maybe me. So I go back and put on my next my next wardrobe, and I'm talking to the guy who's dressing me, who completely never says a word. And I said, there's a guy, and I think he's in the first row, and I think he hates my acting or this goddamn play, and I'm going to find out who he is. So I come out, I do a next scene, I got my one eye, I look over there, and there's this bearded guy in the first row. He's going, and I went, I got him, okay. He's probably a writer who's jealous of Neil Simon's work. Because he's the only one that's laughing when nobody else is. Play over, knock on my door at the end of the play, and there he is. And he goes, I really loved it. I really loved it. I said, it was really great. And I said, you're the guy. You're the guy. He didn't know what I was talking about. You're the guy. You're the guy. He's the one who cast me in Taxi.
He's the one what?
He's the one that got me in Taxi. He's the other writer. He's
oh my god!
Not Jim
Burrows.
Jim Brooks.
Jim Brooks.
Oh wow!
You know Jim Brooks?
Yes, I know Jim Brooks very well.
Fantastic writer.
Fantastic writer.
I'm a genius of comedy.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah, yeah. But that laugh.
Yes,
he has. If you listen to some of the Taxis, if you listen to some of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you can hear the guy. You can hear him laughing in the background.
Listen for that.
He knows what's going to happen. So he goes,
you know that I, Bud Yorkin and I bought Neil Simon, Paramount paid for it, his first show, his first play, Come Blow Your Horn.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote the screenplay.
You did?
Yep. And he never let anybody else write a Neil Simon screenplay again.
He was too sensitive. Let's put it this way. He was too sensitive.
And he, we were doing, this is Ed Simmons and I, we were doing the Martha Raye show. And we finally got a little more, just the two of us, and we finally got a little more money to hire a writer. And we hired two. Danny and Doc Simon.
Oh.
Danny and Doc, his brother. Neil was known as Doc Simon at the very beginning, his brother. I mean, it was Neil Simon. His brother was called Doc. Dissolved to Neil Simon as the biggest writer in the history of theater and show business and whatnot. And his mother lives in a building that my mother lives in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And these elderly women, many of them in that building, would gather in the late afternoon and just chit-chat in the lobby in the late afternoon. My mother and a number of other women there always told this story. One of the women was sitting in a wheelchair was Mrs. Simon. And one day, a young guy walks into the lobby and, girls, girls, she says, I want you to meet my son's brother.
That was Neil.
That was
Neil.
Now, didn't you give up the rights to some Neil Simon plays that you had at one point?
Oh,
I remember in the book.
Yes, yes, yes. We had the right. We had the...
a few of them.
As a result, we had the next two... when we bought Come Blow Your Horn, the deal was that we had the right to the next two Neil Simon plays, should he write them.
Oh.
Pretty good.
We and Paramount. John Henry Fault. Do you remember the name John
yes,
Henry
Yes, I do.
Fault?
Yes, I do.
Fear on Trial.
That's right.
He was a blacklisted guy.
Yeah. I was in the movie.
Yes, on Fear on Trial?
Yeah, I think so. It was on television.
It was on television.
That's
we never got to. We fell in love with the book as we were flying to New York to go to Philadelphia or
Bucks County,
Bucks County
Playhouse, right?
To see Neil Simon's second piece, which was Barefoot in the Park, with Elizabeth Ashley, and Bob Redford,
right.
We loved it, but we had fallen in love with the other piece. We knew that this was going to go to Broadway, Barefoot in the Park. It'd be there for a long time. So we wrote a letter to Paramount saying we'd love to do Barefoot in the Park, but we'd love to do, but it's going to run for a long time. We'd love to do Fear on Trial first.
You're going to do it as a movie or a series?
No, movies.
Movie.
These were both movie ideas. The letter was so poorly written that it could be, and they did, Paramount. We didn't. We were giving up Barefoot in the Park in order to do Fear on Trial.
Oh.
We so Fear on Trial never got made, and we lost the two.
So even Norman Lear makes mistakes.
I know that I was in Fear
It's the
on
only
trial.
One, though.
You remember who the star of Fear on Trial was? Remember it's remember who the guy was who played Falk?
Who? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't.
I can Google it.
He was a guy who talked like this.
That sounds like Pacino.
But I did know him, Falk. I adored him. I adored
him.
It
wasn't Peter Falk, though.
Fear on Trial.
But that's, I love that you said, I think I was in that movie.
I know
that's
I
an
was.
Actor that's worked
I know
a lot.
George C.
I
Scott,
think I was in that movie.
William Devane.
Okay.
William Devane.
Yeah. And we shot it because it was about NBC, right?
Uh-huh.
He was fired and hired by NBC. And we're sitting down in the restaurant in the skating rink, and I met Bill Devane there because I had a part in it or something like that. And I said, "Who do you think is going to win the the Emmy?" Because we were in television. I had a part in some show. He said, "It's either going to be you or me or the guy with the pacemaker." And I said, "Who are you talking about?" He was talking about Henry Fonda, because he was doing the same play he did on TV. All right. But Laurence Olivier did his first show, American show, on TV with Katharine Hepburn, where he played a barrister. And I said, "No, I think it's going to be Larry Olivier." "No way! It's going to be you or me or the guy with the pacemaker." He kept talking about it, but the guy with the pacemaker. I said, "I don't know. I think you're wrong about that." "Nope, you, me, or the pacemaker." And it was Laurence Olivier.
Wow.
He won an Emmy just by being on television. I mean— You
just showing up. Just by
he was showing up.
Showing up.
Yeah.
Because he was Sir Lawrence.
Yeah. That's the only thing he did on American television.
Do we have a Sir out there now?
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah. There's lots of them. Anthony Hopkins.
But nobody calls Sir. Nobody. I've never seen Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Well, I've seen Ben Kingsley gets Sir all the time.
Yeah.
I don't hear Sir Anthony Hopkins that much, really.
No.
Either.
And the Beatle.
Who? Sir John Sir Lennon.
Sir Elton John.
Sir Elton John.
Sir Rod Stewart. John,
right?
I don't get
Sir Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney, he's a sir.
Yeah.
But you never see the sir.
No, but I think it doesn't go with rock and roll. You know, there's a few of them have turned it down. I think David Bowie turned down a knighthood because he wasn't really rock and roll.
Nah, it's not.
Nah. Sir Paul McCartney.
Rebel. I'm a rebel.
That's not punk.
No,
to be a knight.
Punk, right?
No, I know punk wants to be a knight.
Exactly.
It's too cordial. You know what I mean? Who would want to do that? Hell no.
Where do you guys shoot your show?
CBS and Radford.
Oh, and Radford.
Studio City.
Yeah.
A question. So, like, you know, grew up watching Sanford and Son and Good Times. And, you know, Hollywood's getting a lot of, like, you know, flack for lack of diversity in some of the, you know, shows and movies that they put out. I want to know, like, what made you want to produce Good Times and Sanford and Son? Like, as a black dude, I just want to know.
You know, it's so simple. Mm-hmm. The answer is so simple. There was a Maud, and there was an Esther Rolle who played the maiden Maud.
Uh-huh.
And she was terrific. And I thought of her after a time as being in the Bush Leagues. I didn't know that somebody would one day create the phrase spinoff. She was a great performer. And I had conversations with Freddie Silverman at CBS. If she had a husband, we start to see the building of a family. On Maud, we had her husband in a script pick her up one night and cast John Amos. Now we had a couple. Now they were interested in developing a show, give them a couple of kids and developing a show. So it all came out of Esther Rolle's performance on Maud.
Yeah, but you knew at the time, you had to know at the time that developing the family show about them was already going to be like, who's your real audience? And you know what I'm saying?
Oh, that's the net. Well, that's network
at the time.
Talk.
It was their problem. Yeah, at the time.
That's their problem.
And so the network had no, was it CBS?
CBS. Yeah.
They had no questions, no problems, no nothing about selling the show on air.
Oh, sure,
yeah,
sure,
they did.
Sure. But
they
did. But they did the pilot when they saw how successful John Amos and Esther Rolle.
The relationship was.
How long after that was the Jeffersons?
Huh?
the Jeffersons, how long after?
Jeffersons had an interesting beginning. And we were thinking about, well, we had the Jeffersons living next door, starting with Lionel at the very beginning, right, and then his mother. And then I, you know, there was an uncle, Anita, the senior Jefferson, and I couldn't, I didn't have the father cast. I couldn't think of the, we were casting, we were looking for Mr. Jefferson. And so we had an uncle play that role. We,
okay.
Just an actor out of San Francisco. And then one day, somebody, it could have been me, it could have been Jane Murray, who was casting, but reminded me of Pearlie, which was a musical you may remember.
Cleavon Little.
Preceded you. On Broadway. No, Sherman Hemsley.
No, I mean Cleavon Little was in the one on Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. No, Sherman Hemsley did Pearlie. Maybe Cleavon Little was in it, too.
It was called Pearlie Victorious?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
The story about how Sherman Hemsley got that role, there's a story, I don't know if it's an urban legend. I'm not sure if it holds any merit, but apparently he was broke. I think he was poor.
He was
homeless.
Broke.
Yeah.
He was broke when the show ended.
Yeah.
And Red Fox, like they were all in up broke.
That's funny as hell. He was on his last dime, like literal last dime, and he called his manager, his agent. The first thing he called was them, and he was like, "I think I think he was gonna quit or go move somewhere. Or he was finished or whatever." And they were like, "Well, we got a role we think you might be right for," and it was Sherman Hemsley, and he murdered it. Like it was the fucking character.
So. Wasn't he? He was, I mean, he was something to handle, wasn't he?
No.
I mean, no?
Oh, no. He was.
He was always on.
Red Fox was someone.
Oh,
to
I see. Yeah, yeah.
There's a story about him, too. I don't know if it's true, but, like, you know, as a black writer, we get all these, like, urban legends about, like, you know, are the people we looked up to. And Red Fox has a funny story. I was talking about it with you, actually. We're on set. And don't know if it's true, but I do know what I was told was one day. Red Fox was like he wanted to fire all the white writers and bring in more black writers for the show. You know, he wanted more color behind the scenes.
Right.
And the first table read he had with the from the all black writers, that first script, the first table read, no laughs. It got no laughs. And Red Fox got so angry. He was like, "Where my Jews at? Bring the Jews back over here." And they got all they brought back all the white writers. But he was insane. He was insane. It's a legend. I don't know if it's true, but it's one of my favorite stories about just Red Fox, man.
Bring the Jews back. Get my Jews back. Bring the Jews back.
He was, we made the show. It was an NBC show. I had very little to do with the show because of geography. Because it was at NBC in Burbank, and I had three shows at CBS on Fairfax and Beverly. And I heard about all the difficulty that Red Fox was presenting them just because he wanted a window in his dressing room. All of the dressing rooms were in off a hallway.
Uh-huh.
Some of them were large, like his and so forth. They had no windows because it was a hallway. No windows in any of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't make him a window. But it went on and
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I think he wanted to escape from the IRS. Like, he wanted to jump out of the window.
Right, to escape. Well, you know, of all the creative, super creative, crazy people in the history of television, you know, you worked with one of the greats, Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And the Tony Clifton thing always fascinated me. I mean, here you are, one of the great American actors from the theater, and you end up in this situation where who is this? Can you tell a Tony, like, what was that like?
I don't think anybody understood him. I certainly not me. I mean, you know, because we were together, but you never knew you were together with him at all. I don't think anybody ever thought they were together with him. And
with Kaufman.
Yeah. I mean, he had a very early on, he had a show, his stand-up show on one of the theaters here. And we all came. And he did, Presley, and he did Mighty Mouse and all this kind of stuff. He does all this stuff, right? And one day he brings out, he says, "And now the Mormon Tabernacle Choir." And all of a sudden these people in purple come out and they start singing. I said, "That ain't no Mormon Tabernacle Choir." What the fuck he think he's doing here? Just It never said that, you know, like, this is a joke. There's no jokes. He was not a jokester. He was not a, no comedian. He's not a comedian. Okay, so I go. And then he said, and now Rockettes. And all of a sudden, these women come out and start dancing like Rockettes. And I thought, these girls are at least 50. Wait a minute. This does not really – I remember the Rockettes. I used to go to the theater, and they were there, you know, in New York, right? And I said, they're not the Rockettes. What do you think he is? And he comes out. He does the rest of the show and then says and then he does a dare wrestling match, you know, for a woman.
Yeah. Right?
And some guy says, I'll wrestle you. The woman sitting next to me, I did not know, was his mother in the theater. She goes and grabs my arm. What? And I realize, oh, shit, it's his mother. And she does not know that this is going to be new and this guy is going to kill him on stage. And I'm thinking, no, she knows everything. She's playing the act.
Yeah.
The scared mother act. Well, no, it was true.
It was actually his mother.
He always surprised everybody. I mean, he surprised his own mother, you know.
Wow, that's
he
commitment.
Surprised people thinking he was dead.
He was ruthless.
Yeah.
Ruthless.
But when he introduced the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, how many people came out?
A lot of them. He did it like a real rockin' choir.
So that means he had to hire people to do this.
Yes, his shows, he did. So at the end of the show, he says, and now we're all going to go for Milton cookies.
Oh, God.
So the audience goes, huh? And we walk outside. 15 buses come from around the block and pick up the audience.
Wow.
And take us to the what is it called? The spaghetti factory.
For milk and cookies.
And you walked in there, they gave you a little cookie. This is what he did.
This is conceptual more than
what is this guy really trying to show?
Right.
He's trying to show that you might not believe this, but it's true.
So when he showed up on the set as Tony Clifton, you were already ready for that. Yeah,
because he had to play Tony. Remember, he had two contracts on the show. One of them for Tony Clifton and one of them for himself. So we were not to know. In fact, we had a little conference about that on the first read of the show. And they said, listen, he's coming on as Tony Clifton. We're not going to call him not going to call him by his name, right? And you can see the actors going like this. What? Fuck you.
Who was his agent? Who made this deal with the network?
Agent negotiates two separate deals, one for Tony Clifton,
one for the best agent
of all time.
Okay, right, so what happens is he comes on as Tony Clifton and would not say a word that's written. They cast Tony Clifton as Danny DeVito's brother from afar, like a gambler.
Yeah.
So, you know, Tony Clifton, this guy stinks. He's like a lounge lizard.
Like a Vegas lounge lizard.
So I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, we're going through the whole thing, and it's like Wednesday. we shot on Friday. He's not saying a word, and we're all standing there going, like, what the hell's going on with this guy? He's never playing the part. The answer is he's playing the part of a guy who has to get thrown off the stage. This was my vision. I said, he's going so pure on this guy that he has to get thrown out. He has to
get fired.
So I'm standing next to one of the producers, and I said, we're going to shoot on Friday. I said, we only got 2 days. We only have camera blocking tomorrow. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, get him out. He said, what do you want me to do? Call, security? No, I'll do it. So I walked on stage. Andy, get out. And then they called him up and said, we had to fire Tony.
Oh, man. They called Andy?
They played the whole thing.
To tell him they fired Tony.
They played it straight. The producers, they hired him to do this. They called him and he said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Something like that. I knew that would happen or something. You know?
Right.
To call him to tell him about the character he just played.
Oh, my God. I mean, you're just sitting
that's
there
how pure, but this is how pure Andy was about what he did. He had to do it all the way or nothing.
Right, right.
Right? I mean, he'd sit down and read a book until everybody left the audience. He'd bore the crap out of you, you know what I mean? Right. We'd go on the talk shows and make believe he's like somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, I saw him panhandling.
Really?
On a talk show. He's walking up the aisle saying, my wife just got rid of me and I don't have anything to go. And I'm thinking, stop! I think it was Letterman. He didn't know. Every once in a while, they flash over the letter, but he's going like this. I mean, and, you know, he couldn't believe that Andy was, I think, the most daring, I don't know what you call him, you know.
Right. Now, did you feel that way on the day while it was happening?
He was such a normal person, you would not believe it.
Oh, wow.
He was totally a normal person.
But every...
I could have been him.
But,
you know what I mean?
But the networks, the people who hired him, the people who were...
Well, he played...
I mean they allowed him to create a world that wouldn't exist without him.
That's right.
Yeah, well,
that's
say.
Right.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We loved the character. He really just did it as sort of a gas because he really didn't want to. He really wanted to do his own stuff.
Oh, okay.
You know. And he really wasn't a wonderful actor, so he always had to play somebody who was foreign.
Yeah.
And until one day we did a scene, and all of a sudden I'm doing the scene with him, and I had taken out his mother in the show, and he's upset that I might have done something with his mother. And
yeah.
He says, "Ellen, how could you do this?" And I think, oh. And then tears are coming into Andy Kaufman's eyes, and I'm going, whoa, I'm playing this one. I'm going to play this. And there's Burroughs, you know, Jimmy Burroughs directing. And he says, Okay, let's do this again. Now, this time, I go, Jimmy, I think he really wants to act this scene way out. This guy wants to go to cry. I said, I don't know what he's thinking about, but he wants. And that's exactly what he was doing. He was playing I Can Act.
Wow.
You know, everything else that he did, he did besides acting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, wow.
That's kind of some strange genius. I don't know exactly what you call it.
Do you think Jimmy would do this podcast?
Yes.
Yes?
Oh, yeah.
God,
yeah. Oh, get him.
I would love that.
Let's get him. Call him right now. He lives.
I'm surprised he didn't do one of your pilots.
Yeah. Jimmy I'm surprised, too. It just never happened.
I'll give you his email.
Now, how
would...
Yeah,
you can talk to Jimmy.
Well, he's doing Will and Grace.
Yeah,
so.
You can get him on the weekends.
He's available.
With all that stuff going on that show...
The two ladies did it here.
What?
Yeah, that's right.
What two ladies?
From Will and Grace?
Jane and... Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Oh.
But, then Jimmy's coming.
Jane and Lily.
Jimmy will come do it.
They're both here.
Yeah.
But I just wish, with all that...
Oh, you had Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin.
Yeah, they were on the podcast. Yeah. They were great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was cool having them here. Yeah.
I love that show that they just did together.
But you were the center of that show with all that craziness going on. And as an actor, was it... You had to trust what you were doing... You know, in Taxi.
Yeah.
With all that, that's where the theater training must have come in because you're always the focal point of it, even with all this big stuff.
That's why they want. They just wanted a guy who can hold the ground.
That's a lesson in acting.
Everybody else can go wacky. You know, they can rotate.
But that's a lesson in acting.
I remember one time I think I had a line was, why do I come here? I never have a good time. Something like that. I think it was I got so upset about everything that was happening that were depending on me to solve, you know, as the character. And I actually said, why do I come here? I almost always never have a good time. Wait a minute. That's not the line.
Right. Well, if you want to learn acting, young actors out there, watch this guy.
Watch Judd, man.
Watch Judd.
So
more fun now. You know, I might have done a bunch of stuff, but I never did one like this. Not like this. They put me in this. I'm protesting. You know what I'm saying?
It's a period of
illness. It's about time they use me as a guy who can really walk and talk. But I'm thinking.
Who can or
can really. Can yeah. really. Yeah. No. Norman, you have to help me.
I will watch the show.
Make the phone call. Tell him stop doing the old man jokes about this guy.
Because he's a young man.
The crazy thing throughout this entire conversation, I'm thinking, I sold a show to NBC. We sold a show to NBC called Guess Who Died? About life in a retirement village. And the lead is about 73, 74-year-old Jew. And the female lead is Irish. And that's a long story. But I've been sitting here all of this time and for weeks before thinking, where's another Judd Hirsch? Where's another Judd Hirsch?
There's only one, man.
Yeah.
You play such a great part in this damn show. You know, I want to send you the next
episode. But it's about older people. Yeah. So it would be the...
But
people who are living their lives not talking about their age and thinking about their age constantly.
You could do two shows at once.
Yeah.
I keep having this funny dream because when the audience goes out, sometimes we go up and autographs, and I kept on thinking, well, would you come here on our fourth year, please? I'm like, oh, what? Yeah, it comes out. You go like this. Wouldn't that be something? Huh? You know what happens? Everybody becomes a family, as you know,
yes.
Norman, because you've had so many. And they all really did, right? It was always some errant person, but not in ours. I'm sorry. We can't have an errant person in ours because everybody is so glad to be with each other. It's almost like we're all – every time we come on, the audience sees because in between scenes, we're doing dopey stuff.
Well, the same thing with One Day at a Time on Netflix. I mean, it is a family. And we are having the best time in the world together.
I mean, hey, chemistry is everything. It truly
is.
Yeah, we actually enjoy each other's company. In between takes, we're dancing to stupid songs.
Jermaine, you're going to have the last word because it's coming up.
Oh.
And you represent the youth at the table and more of tomorrow than the rest of us.
All right. Cool. Let me know when you want me to do that.
Right now.
All right, as a gay man.
That's a newly gay man.
only I know
for
that.
As a gay man for this broadcast
for
only.
For this broadcast only, and then I'm back to normal after it's over. No, first of all, I really appreciate being in all y'all company. Like, this is I'm a huge sponge. I like listening to people, and listening to this conversation has made me, like, I love it. It made me.
He's going to do you after this.
I love it too. I could have said the same thing. Oh. I'm a sponge that way too. I love. I listen well as yak.
No, but
listening to Judd.
I guess
it's every day. The dude's a masterful actor, and he thinks like. He's a great thinker. He picks things apart like nobody's business. So anytime he's doing a scene, I'll just shut up and watch the dude work. That's just how I work. And I've become a better actor because of this guy. And thank you for everything.
Thank you.
I'm dead serious. So, you know, I'm glad you're still going at it because you're a genius. So
we're still going at it.
Hell yeah, man. Yeah. I'm glad
this was totally an honor.
Yeah,
Mr. Lear, it was
on both sides of this table, ladies and gentlemen. It's a,
Paul, you're hilarious.
It's a 6-foot table.
You guys.
Thank you, Mr. Hip.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
double hips.
Paul. Yeah,
double hips.
Yeah, he does. He has two hips.
Yeah, he's double jointed.
Did I tell you about the name? Oh, I think I already.
That's another
that
broadcast.
This has because been if all you do, of the above. With,
because if you do, I'm going to have another story.
With Judd Hirsch and Jermaine.
Greer.
I knew you would say that if I didn't have it. Paul Hipp and I have a good everything.
Hey, everybody, it's Heather Dubrow. Come join me for Heather Dubrow's World exclusively on Podcast One. We have so many fun conversations and great guests. Recently, Corinne Olympios from The Bachelor was here, Suzanne Summers, Matt Eisman, Tamara Judge, my buddy, was here. All kinds of really fun. Randy Jackson, Kellan Lutz. I didn't let him bite me. Join me every Friday on PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, and subscribe to Apple Podcasts.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
Have some of mine, and life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.